I next met with Dr. Anthony Mato, and to begin, he talked about a number of Phase 3 data sets that have been presented in the last year, beginning with several during the ASH meeting in December.
ASH and ASCO this year really have been practice-changing for oncologists. You know, we had the great fortune at ASH to have several studies presented that really provide a thematic change for patients with CLL. There were the data presented from the ECOG 1912, the Alliance trial, the Illuminate trial, and then updated data from the Murano trial. And, you know, the big picture theme is that the days of chemotherapy or chemoimmunotherapy for patients with CLL are really coming to an end, with the exception of very, very specific patient groups. You know, in the ECOG trial, we saw FCR, which had been a great standard of care for patients, you know, compared to ibrutinib and rituximab. And ibrutinib and rituximab was better in terms of the primary endpoint for progression-free survival. The Alliance trial was a similar question, but for older patients, and there ibrutinib with or without rituximab was compared to bendamustine and rituximab. And again, same primary endpoint was met for progression-free survival. We saw the CLL11 regimen, which was obinutuzumab plus chlorambucil, challenged by the combination of ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab. And there, again, a primary endpoint of progression-free survival was met. And then we saw updated data from the Murano trial, which was venetoclax plus rituximab compared to bendamustine and rituximab in the relapse refractory setting. Updated PFS data, OS data, depth of response data. But I think more importantly, that was the first novel agent combination that allowed for a fixed duration for patients. All of the data that I mentioned with ibrutinib, either alone or with rituximab or with obinutuzumab, is continuous therapy, which is something that patients do question at times. The venetoclax therapy was a fixed duration of 24 months, and then all patients stopped. And we got a window into what happens the first year after discontinuation, where we saw about a 13% rate of progression for patients, so sort of a modest rate of progression off therapy, with the hope and expectation that those patients could be rechallenged with venetoclax when they develop symptomatic CLL that warrants an intervention. So that was ASH, and that's a lot of information for just one meeting. Then at the ASCO meeting, we saw the CLL14 presented, which was the combination of venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. And there the comparison was the CLL11 regimen, sort of a modified CLL11 regimen of obinutuzumab plus chlorambucil. Randomized trial, older patients, a lot of comorbidities. And there the primary endpoint was met for progression-free survival. But that's the second trial that showed a fixed duration of novel agent chemotherapy for patients there. Everybody got treated with 1 year worth of therapy and then discontinued. So we're moving more towards combinations where improving the CR rate, the MRD undetectable rate, and because of that, patients are able to stop therapies and have these breaks that are hopefully lasting several years before we even need to rethink about rechallenging patients.
You know, it's interesting in listening to investigators discuss various diseases, we as a CME group often generate algorithms kind of based on what we hear. And we have this algorithm we've been developing the last year, you know, based on P53, DEL17P, and IGVH mutation. And at ASH, it just totally blew up. You know, it's just like things completely changed. And then, as you say, they changed even more at ASCO. And for somebody in general oncology practice is also trying to keep up with, you know, which PD-L1 assay to do and, you know, bladder cancer or whatever, it's not very easy to sort out. So let me just ask you some macro questions with this huge amount of data coming in. The first thing is you mentioned the idea of this sort of short-term treatment. Often that is integrated with MRD measurement. Can you talk a little bit more about that strategy and whether you think it would be reasonable to do right now outside of trial setting at community practice?
Well, making treatment decisions based on MRD is sort of a goal, and it's not really ready for community or academic practice at this point. You know, the two trials that I mentioned with fixed duration, the Murano trial and the CLL14, were really one size fits all for all patients. Everybody either got 24 months worth of therapy or 12 months worth of therapy and then stopped. So there is no decision point yet integrated into novel agent-based therapy that's based on an MRD endpoint. You know, these trials have performed MRD assessments in the blood or in the bone marrow, either by PCR or by sequencing or by flow cytometry. And they're very happy to report that there are high proportion of patients who are MRD undetectable exceeding 60 or 70%. But if you actually look at the trial design, for practical purposes, everybody gets treated exactly the same regardless of their MRD results. So if you're getting venetoclax in the relapse refractory setting, you get ven plus rituximab 24 months and stop. Probably the patients who are MRD undetectable at the end of therapy do better, but it's still not a decision point. And the same is true with the CLL14 with the 12 months of obina plus ven and then stop. But the hope, and I really feel the future is going to be, you know, we shouldn't do one size fits all targeted agents for patients, and we should be making decisions based on biology. And one of those endpoints should be assessment of MRD. But we don't even have studies yet available that would support that decision making.
So your point's well taken. I guess what I should say then is, what about the strategy of using short-term treatment in general outside a clinical trial?
I think clinical practice is ready for that, absolutely. You know, venetoclax, and really the only strategy we have right now with the novel agent is venetoclax. That was approved initially as a continuous agent, relapse refractory setting for DEL17P patients, but that's been expanded now. And so both in the frontline and relapse refractory setting, there is really a lot of experience, both at academic centers and emerging in community centers, to use venetoclax for a fixed duration and then stop. So I think right now across the US and certainly in my practice, we're using venetoclax that way, both frontline and relapse refractory. So we're there already.
So I could imagine in a patient who's tolerating, let's say, novel therapy well, that, you know, might be a difficult decision to stop therapy. Would you advise against looking at MRD?
I wouldn't advise against it, but I would highlight that it's still a research question. And, you know, to be completely fair, these approvals are so relatively new that even in my practice, we don't have a lot of patients receiving standard of care, either ven rituximab or ven obina, who've gotten to 24 or 12 months where we've had to really face that question. And we're talking about an approval for ven in the frontline setting that's about 3 weeks old. So there really shouldn't be a lot of patients in practice that are receiving that combination where that decision point has been met yet. But I agree, if I have a patient at 12 months who has MRD persistent disease or detectable disease, it's going to be a conversation that will be a prolonged conversation, and we won't have a lot of data to help support the decision. So I think it's going to be an important question in the near future.
Yeah, I mean, it might be fine to stop therapy even in a patient who's MRD positive, but I just kind of reminds me of the conversations I have with the myeloma people. You talk about using MRD to decide about transplant, and they go, oh, well, the data's not there. But on the other hand, from kind of a clinical point of view, it sort of makes sense, but I guess that's maybe for the future.
Yeah, I can tell you we're designing about 5 trials right now at MSK where decision-making is going to be based on MRD. So it's very relevant right now and from a research perspective.
So another sort of macro question I have, seeing all these data come out, is the issue of anti-CD20 therapy plus novel therapy, wesibrutinib plus venetoclax. And I know you've, you know, written about this. What evidence do we have, whether it's obinutuzumab or rituximab, that these agents in the long term, because, you know, we could use them on relapse too, in the long term, it's better to give with these novel agents?
I think that's probably one of the most important questions right now in CLL. And I think one of the major, major limiting factors of clinical trials to date is the fact that we have these novel agents that were approved as monotherapies, but very infrequently do the trials looking at combinations include either ibrutinib or venetoclax as a monotherapy to really guide us, you know, what's the incremental benefit of adding other agents to that drug, which is already great and a standard of care. And there's, you know, a couple of examples I would highlight from ASH last year and the year before. The MD Anderson group presented data in the relapse refractory setting of ibrutinib plus or minus rituximab. Before the trial was conducted, everybody would have said rituximab is going to add to depth of response. They'll be more durable, they'll be deeper, and the PFS will be better. But there was absolutely no difference in PFS or overall survival. So rituximab added nothing in the relapse refractory setting. And then we have the Alliance data that were presented at this ASH meeting looking at ibrutinib plus or minus rituximab in the frontline setting versus BR, and there was absolutely no benefit to adding rituximab to ibrutinib. So I think for rituximab plus ibrutinib, we have an answer to randomized trial. Rituximab adds nothing to ibrutinib. The question of obinutuzumab is a little bit more open-ended, but of course it's not answered. The Illuminate trial was ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab versus obina plus chlorambucil. I would have argued strongly that ibrutinib should have been included as a monotherapy control, a three-arm trial, and it wasn't conducted that way. So we don't know if obina adds to ibrutinib. I think most people in practice are extrapolating from the rituximab experience. There is a trial that's very interesting right now that would be reported, I think, within the next year or so, which is the BTK inhibitor acalabrutinib versus acalabrutinib plus obinutuzumab versus obinutuzumab plus chlorambucil. That's a frontline trial. And there, fortunately, we have the glycoengineered anti-CD20 with or without the novel agent. So that'll probably help settle the question for obina with a BTK inhibitor. I think venetoclax is even more unanswered because we have the Ven data from the relapse refractory setting as a monotherapy. Looks great. But the Murano trial did not include a Ven mono as a control. And the CLL14 did not include a Ven mono as a control. So we really don't know the incremental benefit, if there is one, to adding a CD20 to venetoclax. About 20 centers from around the world got together and we contributed our data for Ven plus or minus a CD20 as, you know, one of these retrospective real-world studies where we wanted to try to answer the question that wasn't going to be answered in the context of a trial. And we published those data in Blood Advances. And we didn't see any benefit to adding a CD20 to venetoclax, which I really think speaks to the value of those types of studies in trying to answer questions that may not easily be answered in the context of clinical research.
So one subset that's sort of been out there for a while and got shaken up a lot at ASH is the younger patient who could potentially tolerate FCR with IGVH mutated P53-del17P negative disease, where people, I still hear investigators saying FCR for the idea of short-term treatment, long-term benefit. Where are you on that question today?
I do still think there is a role for FCR in that very, very highly selected patient population that you already stated, the TP53 intact, IGHV mutated, younger, and I would define younger as 65 or younger based on the clinical trials experience. You know, it's hard to argue with 2 decades worth of long-term follow-up data from various centers, starting with MD Anderson, but also looking at data from Germany and from Italy, that supports the point that there probably is a proportion of patients in that subgroup who receive FCR and may be cured of their disease. If not cured, treated to a point where the remission is so deep that it will not likely return during the course of their lifetime. And it is really interesting, but if you dissect the data from CLL14, from the ECOG trial, from the Alliance trial, and you look specifically at the subgroup of patients who are IGHV mutated, there's really no difference in outcomes. The hazard ratios are not significant. So I think it's still an unanswered question. And probably what we need to do moving forward is trials really need to be designed looking at patients stratified by IGHV status. Unmutated patients probably warrant a different trial design than mutated patients. So I recently saw a patient in the office who's young and fit and who meets those characteristics perfectly. And part of our conversation was that there is still a role for FCR for that patient, and it is something that needs to be considered.
So I guess one issue might be this idea of short-term novel agent therapy or combinations. You know, maybe that might offer sort of an FCR-like short-term model.
I think so. But again, the same point as earlier with some of the other trials is that the way these combination studies are being designed, they're demonstrating high rates of response and undetectable disease. But there's definitely a trade-off. And when you look at the AE data for a combination like ibrutinib and venetoclax, it's certainly much higher than either agent alone. And I think that the question that will always remain outstanding in my mind, and just using that as an example, is do we use all of our best agents together, or is there really a value in giving these agents in sequence with one another? And you could look at the data from the Resonate 2 trial, which was the frontline ibrutinib trial. We're at 5+ years, and we still haven't reached the median PFS. You could look at the Murano or the venetoclax data, which is available following ibrutinib or idelalisib. You're looking at a minimum median PFS of 24.5 months. So you start to argue, you know, 50, 60 median PFS for ibrutinib, 3 years with venetoclax. How do you come up with a combination that starts exceeding that when you start thinking about the PFS in sequence? So I think the combinations may offer a window into short duration of therapy, but we also really don't know a lot about the side effects. And the big question in my mind is, when you give drugs like ibrutinib, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab together, what does resistance look like in that patient if and when they finally progress? Is it driven by BTK or BCL2? Are they CD20 refractory? You know, we barely understand the biology to resistance to any of these agents by themselves. So I think it's uncharted waters, and regardless of how many of these studies are published and how spectacular the data look, until we have some more randomized data or sequencing questions answered, I'm a little bit hesitant to jump on that bandwagon.
You said something that I don't know that I've heard before, which is that when you combine in a BTK inhibitor and venetoclax or ibrutinib and venetoclax, you have significant increase in AEs?
Yeah. If you look at the data, there's most recently data published in New England Journal of Medicine looking at ibrutinib plus venetoclax, certainly more AEs and different AEs than either agent given alone. You could argue whether or not those AEs are additive or synergistic, but there's a higher proportion of, you know, I think this is true in all of oncology and not related to CLL specifically, but the more drugs you put together, the more additive the toxicities are for patients.
Well, in a way, you know, like I would assume these are BTK type toxicities because, I mean, you tell me, what are the toxicities of venetoclax once you get people through TLS?
Hematologic toxicities.
Hematologic. So you see more cytopenias, for example?
Yeah, exactly. So you see neutropenia, thrombocytopenia. And what's interesting to me, and this is still unanswered from the combination questions, is if you really dissect the data for the combinations like the one I just mentioned, there is a very significant proportion of patients, probably still a minority, but bordering on a majority, that are requiring dose reductions of one or both agents because of the fact that there are hematologic toxicities, for example, or arthralgias, for example, or AFib, for example. So those things really do need to be considered. Are two drugs at lower doses better than one drug at the FDA-approved dose? Still don't know that answer.
But I mean, do you think that the BTK-type toxicities like atrial fibrillation or arthralgias are greater if you add in venetoclax?
I don't know that for sure, although you might argue that AFib could be more exacerbated if you have, you know, for example, exacerbation of anemia with another drug that has myelosuppression, you know, it's more stress on the heart. We don't know that for sure, but certainly if you look at all grade AEs or grade 3-4 AEs, I do think with the combinations, the novel-novel doubles or the novel-novel plus anti-CD20 triples, that there is a higher rate of toxicity that definitely needs to be presented to patients as part of informed consent.
So I'm going to get into some of your cases, but first ask you a real simple question, which is, what's first-line therapy of CLL nowadays?
There's not one right answer to that question. I think what you alluded to earlier about performing a prognostic evaluation is really key. So there's a lot of different prognostic markers that one could perform, but it probably really boils down to 3 or 4. And that's checking IGHV status, FISH specifically for deletion 17P. The others don't matter as much to me. Next generation sequencing specifically for a TP53 mutation. And that information together really can help to guide therapy. If a patient is a perfect candidate for FCR, like we talked about earlier, it's still part of the conversation. Otherwise, things have gotten much simpler for patients at this and oncologists at this point in time. It really boils down to novel agent-based therapy with the 2 or 3 choices available, ibrutinib, ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab, or venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. Of course, we don't have head-to-head comparative data of ibrutinib plus ven, so the conversation is really a long one discussing the advantages and disadvantages of ibrutinib and venetoclax, and I could get into that because it is something that we talk about every day with patients. You know, with ibrutinib, it's a continuous therapy, so that may be one disadvantage that patients may consider. But on the other hand, we have 5-plus years follow-up as a first therapy, so that's reassuring for patients. And we have sequencing data available. There are prospective data which support the use of venetoclax following discontinuation of ibrutinib. You're looking at a 65-70% overall response rate, a median PFS of 24 months. A disadvantage of ibrutinib is it does have certain toxicities that need to be addressed: rash, arthralgia, bleeding, bruising, atrial fibrillation, and infection. Those are some of the ones that we think about. Venetoclax, it's a little bit of a different conversation. It's a time-limited therapy, but of course, as a first therapy, it's not a monotherapy. It's given with an infusion, obinutuzumab, so you have to commit to that 6 months worth of infusion. You know, the ramp-up can be cumbersome at times depending on your TLS risk, and so you might be in the office a fair amount for the first 5 weeks of therapy or even hospitalized. The AE profile is different, but it's not insignificant. There is a risk of TLS, which is very low if you follow the rules, but also hematologic toxicity, some minor GI toxicity. Probably one of the biggest limiting factors at this point is we don't really know which therapies work best after venetoclax. It's not to say ibrutinib wouldn't work. It's just that I couldn't cite a study that gives us prospective data to support that. There's, you know, like a case series from Australia with 6 or 7 patients. There's a few from the US that we reported, but really not a lot of robust prospective data to support that sequencing strategy. So it's one of these situations where for patients and oncologists, we want to have this level one evidence to help choose one therapy versus another. And the truth of the matter is that they're both great therapies, and we just have to live with the limitations of the clinical trials.
So if a patient says to you, just from a quality life point of view, I understand, you know, the issues about efficacy might be a little complicated, but in terms of how a patient's going to feel, how would you compare sort of life on ibrutinib to life on venetoclax?
I've had to discontinue both drugs due to adverse event, but when they work well, and I would say, you know, the answer to most patients is in the vast majority of cases, either ibrutinib or venetoclax, they have a great quality of life, certainly relative to chemotherapy days, that we try to take it a case-by-case basis. If I have a patient who has really significant, poorly controlled hypertension, atrial fibrillation, they're on blood thinners, you know, that may not be the best patient for me to start ibrutinib. If I have a patient, you know, I have a patient who I mentioned earlier to you has von Willebrand's disease, has a bleeding diathesis already, probably not going to start ibrutinib. If I have a patient who's already starting off with significant neutropenia related to their CLL, then I may not think venetoclax is the best therapy for that patient, particularly short term from a risk of infection. So I think the answer is not one over the other, but really knowing your patient, knowing the drugs, and also knowing yourself. If you have much more experience using ibrutinib and managing their AEs, it's probably the better drug. The same is also true for venetoclax. If your office is not well equipped to do a ramp up, then it's probably not the best choice for a patient. So you have to really consider all three of those factors.
When you start out with a patient who doesn't have any significant comorbidities, in your mind, what are you thinking over time is the likelihood that they're going to have to stop ibrutinib over 1 year, 3 years, 5 years because of some type of adverse problem?
Yeah, so we've reported these data from the real-world studies, and the clinical trials are largely with long-term follow-up confirming. Approximately, I would say, 1/5 of patients would have to stop a drug due to an adverse event over some period of time, let's say over the first 5 years worth of therapy. You know, it's the most common reason for discontinuation, and it's a little bit different when you're talking about frontline or relapse refractory setting. So I would say either 10 or 20% of patients will discontinue due to an adverse event. Now, whether or not that adverse event could be managed medically, I think is another question. There are certain cases where an oncologist may have AFib that's relatively well controlled, but not feel comfortable to continue the drug. I've actually found that working with cardiologists, internists, cardio-oncologists really closely, there are very few ibrutinib-related events that absolutely mandate discontinuation of the drug. It's really a question of what your resources are, or at your center, do you have partnerships with other specialties where you feel comfortable to manage through those events?
It's interesting because when you say 10 or 20%, that kind of sounds low compared to other estimates. But now, are you talking about in your hands or out in the community?
I'm talking about in the community. And the reason being is that some of the literature that we've published has been misquoted. We've always talked about ibrutinib, and the most common reason for discontinuation is adverse event. The number that we've published is 50% of discontinuations. But oftentimes that 50% gets quoted. It's really, you know, it's 50% of the discontinuation rate. In the relapse refractory setting, we quoted the discontinuation rate was about 40%, but that included progression, transformation, financial issues. In the frontline setting, we reported 24% discontinuation rate. So half of that would be due to AE. So that brings you to around 12.5%.
So you were talking about atrial fibrillation. I've got to ask you about this paper in a journal that I don't usually read, Cancer Biology and Therapy, on left atrial abnormality as a predictor of ibrutinib atrial fibrillation. Never heard of that.
So that was really a project I had enjoyed doing. I did that with Dr. Joe Carver, who is the head of cardio-oncology at University of Pennsylvania. And that was an attempt to try to understand which of our patients would develop atrial fibrillation prior to the start of ibrutinib. And we had this hypothesis that, you know, if patients had any abnormality in conduction within the atria or the size of the atria, those patients would be at highest risk. And so I worked with Dr. Carver to develop three different criteria looking at conduction delays or P. mitrali or other abnormalities that you could see in the atria that might predict which patients would develop AFib later on. And it was really simple. You could use the ECG, very reproducible criteria. Any internist or cardiologist could follow those guidance. And the odds ratio was somewhere between 2 and 3 that those patients would be at higher risk. I wouldn't say if you had those abnormalities that you shouldn't use the drug because it's still a relatively low risk. But I would say if there's something wrong with the atria on an ECG, it's probably worth getting an echo. It's worth paying more attention to that patient, looking for symptoms, palpitations, anything that might be suggestive of AFib. Because if you catch it early, you can manage these patients with rate control, plus or minus an aspirin or anticoagulation. And so we presented that 2 years ago now at the IWCLL meeting, which was in New York City. And we published those data in Cancer Biology and Therapy, which is a very neat journal where they allow bench to bedside or bedside to bench articles to be presented.
Yeah, I've got to check that out. Are you actually doing that in your practice? Have you incorporated that?
It's not a formal incorporation, but we do look at patients' ECGs to see whether or not there's anything that might raise a concern. And certainly at Penn, if I had any patient like that, I would have immediately recommended they see Dr. Carver. The same is true at MSK with our cardio-oncology group.
Interesting. So another paper I want to ask you about that you did, I'm always fascinated by real-world outcomes work, and you've done a lot of it. And in particular, I was curious about this paper you had looking at real-world outcomes related to venetoclax. I've been curious about that in terms of what people are actually doing. What did you find there?
So that was a paper that we published in Hematologica last year where we were gathering data from centers across the world. A huge amount of data came from US, but also a large amount came from the UK, where we wanted to just look at everyone's practice for use of venetoclax and try to understand how well was the drug performing, what were the adverse events, what was the risk of TLS, were people following the FDA label, were they deviating from it, really gives you a window into how these drugs perform out of the context of clinical research. For anybody who's conducted a clinical trial, this is really an elite group of patients. They're usually very fit, they have the best organ function, their creatinine clearances are over a certain threshold. So this was a chance for us to get a first look at Ven post-approval. And actually, the drug performed quite well. This was one of the real-world experiences where I felt the data pretty closely matched the data from clinical trials. There certainly were probably a slightly higher rate of AEs that were reported, grade 3-4 toxicities. TLS seemed to be a little bit more prevalent than one might have expected from the clinical trials. But also keep in mind, it was an older patient population. Creatinine clearances were likely decreased. But overall, we had a pretty favorable impression of the Ven experience. People were very closely following the label, actually to an extreme. There were more patients hospitalized for TLS ramp up for monitoring and prophylaxis than even would have been required per label. So it was interesting to get that look. And we've subsequently published another paper in CCR this year where we were trying to do a little bit of modeling of TLS risk, but also get another look a year later to see if things have changed significantly.
So you did the study, or how did you actually, I'm just kind of curious how you did this.
This is an unfunded, all of the real world studies that we've published have been unfunded trials where we've really come up with these questions that are not only relevant in our practice, but relevant to our patients. And I think the proof of the fact that they're relevant is the fact that we email colleagues or reach out to colleagues from different centers around the world and say, hey, would you be willing to participate? The answer has always unanimously been, this is really worthwhile. We want to know the same thing. But in any practice, even MSK or Penn or anywhere where you work, there's probably not enough patients at one center to answer the question. So we've worked really hard to put together this informal consortium of centers worldwide where every time we have a relevant question, we get together and we pool our data, obviously through, you know, having IRB-approved retrospective protocols for this type of work, combine, analyze, and then as a group decide what are the relevant findings and then present those at meetings like ASH or ASCO or IWCLL and present the papers. I think probably over the last 3 or 4 years, we've had somewhere between 6 and 8 real-world papers that were published. As a result, we're working on one now focused on venetoclax, where we've had over 40 centers worldwide from as far away as Russia send us emails requesting to participate because they really want to share their data participate in the experience. And I think everybody recognizes that there are just not going to be certain clinical trials conducted. And really the only way for us to answer questions for our patients specifically is to gather our information. It's better to collaborate and share data than it is to be isolated in a silo where no one's working together. And actually one interesting thing that's come out of this is that we've identified questions from our retrospective studies that we think are relevant for clinical trials, and we've actually gone on to then conduct the clinical trials. We developed a trial looking at a PI3K inhibitor, umbralisib, specifically for ibrutinib or idelalisib intolerant patients to see whether or not we could class switch and maintain response. That trial completely was born from the real world trial that we published in 2015 in Blood, where we were looking at class switching between ibrutinib and idela. So this informal real-world group is now actually turned into a consortium where we're conducting clinical trials together, and the questions are all coming from the retrospective reviews.
Another question that occurred to me as you were just sort of chatting about this, you know, real shift towards novel agents is where chemoimmunotherapy is going to fit in, particularly in the relapse setting. What do you see happening in the future? I mean, people are saying chemo is out, but is it really chemo is out first line, but it's going to be coming in more in relapse disease?
Great question. Absolutely no data available to support use of chemo following novel agents. What we're finding from our studies is that once a patient seems to go on this track of getting a novel agent or an antibody, there are very few oncologists who are then switching back to chemo. So I have all these patients in our database who got Obinna, then ibrutinib, then idelalisib, then venetoclax, you know, four lines of therapy later. The expectations that chemotherapy would work well are unknown. I think that these registries that are ongoing, and there's several, the ones I mentioned, the Informed CLL, the Core CLL, are all trying to capture these patients who go on to chemo post. But from the clinical trials, once you come off drug, you're censored, so we never know what they get anyway. But I certainly am keeping it in my back pocket. And for anyone who's IGHV mutated, for example, and require a drug and they don't have a novel agent option, I'm definitely not excluding the use of chemotherapy for those patients.
I think, you know, I guess we should have mentioned, though, in terms of the FCR versus ibrutinib, that I guess it's not really clear in the mutated patients kind of whether there's a difference.
Correct. The hazard ratio, I think, was something like 0.47. So it was favoring the ibrutinib, but it was not significant. And that's also true with ibrutinib versus BR. And that's also true with ibrutinib versus obinachlorambucil. The same is true for Ven. There's no significant advantage that's been detected yet in the mutated patients. So it's totally open question for discussion and debate.
So one thing I want to ask you about before we get into your cases, you hear more and more about musculoskeletal toxicities with BTK inhibitors, specifically ibrutinib. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about that right now?
So physiologically, we know nothing. You know, there's really not a lot of information to understand the mechanism of action, but clinically, it is a major adverse event that seems to be leading to discontinuation of the drug. I think a little bit more frontline than in the relapse refractory setting. And unfortunately, without knowing the mechanism of action, it's very hard to know how to address it. Some people, and this is me included, will dose reduce. Others will hold the drug, rechallenge, sometimes rechallenge with corticosteroids on board for a short period of time. But people are trying coenzyme Q, they're using quinine, they're discontinuing statins. There's a whole list of potential things that one could be tried. One of our fellows, Dr. Joanna Rhodes from University of Penn, did perform a retrospective trial looking at the experience from University of Pennsylvania of patients who developed arthralgias, and she presented that at ASH. And while there wasn't a clear-cut risk factor that predicted arthralgia, and there wasn't a clear strategy that seemed to work above all others, there were several strategies that she presented that seemed reasonable to try. So we do many of those things before we discontinue ibrutinib in the setting of arthralgia. The other thing I will add is that if the arthralgias or the myalgias happen early, particularly arthralgias, I think sometimes they're confused with gout. And so I've had a lot of patients who I start ibrutinib, they complain of these really bad joint pains in the first like 2 to 6 weeks worth of therapy. And I really find that a short course of steroids, either taking a break or during the ibrutinib therapy, can quell the arthralgias, and those patients go on to do just fine. So I think you have to distinguish whether or not they're almost an immediate toxicity, and that's possibly due to gout, or whether it's they can occur much later on in the course, and that probably is a true treatment-related toxicity due to ibrutinib.
What is a typical clinical story that you see? Where's the pain? Is it related to exercise or time of the day, or what happens?
Actually, the most common thing that I hear from patients is that the joints hurt in areas where they were previously injured. So, you know, if they had a bad knee from osteoarthritis, for example, or some other joint, a shoulder that was injured previously, that pain seems to be exacerbated. That's one common clinical scenario. So you could almost, sometimes I'll almost say to them, you know, they say they have joint pain. I'll say, okay, is it in a place that was previously injured? And they'll be like, you know what? I did injure that knee 5 years ago.
Wow.
So that's one story. Another story are in the small joints. So I'll see the, you know, the fingers and the toes are painful or the wrists are painful. That's another common presentation that we see. So I think those are the two most common for me. And like I said, I think the small joint issue may be more related to gout without hyperuricemia, and the other one may be truly exacerbation of inflammation. Ibrutinib affects B cells and T cells. It certainly has pro-inflammatory effects, and that may be part of the story.
I was going to ask you in terms of the immune effects of BTK inhibitors. Ibrutinib now, I think, is used for graft versus host disease. What do we know about the immune effects, and do you think the arthralgia you were suggesting, it might be immune-related?
It may be. You know, what we're learning more and more about these drugs is that, number one, they are not pure inhibitors of whatever target we say their inhibitors are. Ibrutinib is not a pure BTK inhibitor. Idelalisib, same thing with PI3K. There are probably next generation drugs that are slightly cleaner, but they're also not pure inhibitors of a particular target. Ibrutinib inhibits ITK. It inhibits and interacts with TEC family of kinases, so it inhibits platelet function, for example. There may be cardiac targets for ibrutinib, which is where the AFib may come from. So they certainly have both pro- and anti-inflammatory effects that are very, very difficult to understand. And you mentioned graft-versus-host disease, which may be one way of addressing, you know, the potential mechanisms of GVHD. On the other hand, ibrutinib is being combined with CAR T cells in lymphoma and CLL with the hope of activating T cells. And so it's really not as straightforward that it's pro or anti-inflammatory in terms of its mechanism of action, at least not to me.
Ibrutinib with CAR T, I'm not sure I've heard that one.
There are at least two oral presentations at the last ASH meeting, ASH 2018. One of them was from a colleague at Penn, Dr. Sar Gill, where the hypothesis, which had been born from the laboratory, Dr. Marco Ruella, had looked at the combination of ibrutinib and CAR Ts and found, because of its effects on T cells and how it can shift the T cell repertoire, that it may actually activate CAR T cells and may improve outcomes. And so not only has that been seen in the lab and in these small center trials, you know, the single center trials like Penn and others, same has been reported from MSK experience, but also now the larger trials are allowing patients on ibrutinib to receive CAR T with the hope that it may have them work better. And certainly the CAR T experience in CLL has not been as great as has been in lymphoma and has been in ALL, particularly pediatric ALL. CAR Ts work in about a quarter or a third of cases, and we don't really have long-term follow-up data, but certainly not the high proportion of patients we saw in pediatric ALL, for example. So there's certainly room for improvement.
Yeah, we've worked on a number of occasions with your former colleague, David Porter, and I always thought CLL was going to be a bigger story with CAR T, and I kind of thought it seemed like it was more that all the novel agents and all were making it sort of less relevant, but you're saying that it really wasn't as effective. I'm assuming some of your patients were treated with CAR T when you were at Penn?
Yes, and I enrolled patients, for example, on that trial, and I was actually an author on that trial looking at CAR T plus ibrutinib. I think you're right. It's a combination of the two things. David Porter reported that three-patient, I think, initial CAR T experience, New England Journal of Medicine, I think it was 2013, unbelievably active in that small subset of patients.
Right.
But then 2014, ibrutinib, idelalisib, obinutuzumab get approved, and all of a sudden, it's a very, very crowded space. CAR Ts can be expensive. They have a real toxicity profile, neurotoxicity, cytokine release syndrome, need for prolonged hospitalization. And so I think it became harder and harder to justify enrolling patients on those trials before they had exhausted all other options. And, you know, in 2013, all other options weren't that long of a list. But in 2019, all other options, you know, we have four novel agents approved for CLL in 5 years. And we're about to have a fifth and a sixth. And so it's a long list of agents to go through before you could justify a cellular therapy.
You know, it's funny. I think people coming into oncology, maybe they don't really see like how crazy things are right now. When we were at ASCO, I was showing the agenda from a meeting we did in lung cancer 5 years ago, 2014, and the word checkpoint inhibitors was not in the agenda 5 years ago. That's incredible. So that's just lung cancer. CLL seems like it's even more, you know, complicated. But let's talk about how this is really playing out in clinical practice. And maybe we can just sort of touch on these cases, beginning with this 75-year-old lady.
So this is a 75-year-old woman who had some comorbidities, who was treated in 2014, borderline early 2014, with FCR. She had some high-risk features, including a 17p deletion, which in 2019 would have mandated ibrutinib or venetoclax therapy for her, but at the time it wasn't available. So she did achieve a deep remission. She had a CR, but she had persistent disease. And of course, like all patients who have high-risk features who receive chemoimmunotherapy, there's a high rate of relapse. She relapsed and ultimately went on to receive ibrutinib as a standard of care. Of course, that drug was initially approved in the relapse refractory setting in 2014 and then subsequently approved in the frontline setting for patients with ADEL17P. She goes on to receive ibrutinib, tolerates it reasonably well initially, but then she had some side effects. And I think the side effects that she had were significant arthralgias and hypertension, which is probably one of the most under-recognized toxicities related to ibrutinib, because plenty of people walk around with hypertension and have absolutely no symptoms at all from it. The ibrutinib was dose reduced as a potential strategy for mitigating the arthralgia issue to 280 milligrams per day from 420. And right now she's tolerating it just fine and has no recurrence of that particular toxicity. So that case really illustrates a lot of important points. Number one, the standard of care has changed for DEL17P positive patients. Number two, toxicities can occur that are either clinically symptomatic or silent, like arthralgia, symptomatic or silent, like hypertension. And then the third is that it's reasonable to consider dose reductions of ibrutinib in the setting of a toxicity before discontinuing the drug. And in this case, the woman went on to a lower dose to maintain her response, but has not had significant morbidity from receiving ibrutinib.
So yeah, again, getting back to my point, it's really breathtaking to think about the fact that ibrutinib was not around in that's 5 years ago, 2000. It wasn't around. Now it's, I mean, it's just amazing what's going on right now. You know, the point about hypertension is really great. I don't even remember people talking about it. First of all, what's the mechanism?
Same answer as earlier with arthralgia. We don't yet know the mechanism. Actually, at the EHA meeting, one of our fellows, Dr. Lindsay Roker, presented a poster on over 200 patients that she followed who received ibrutinib, where she estimated not only the rate of incident hypertension, but the rate of hypertension exacerbation and how well oncologists and internists do in managing that. And actually, the numbers are really impressive. There's approximately 35 to 40% rate of incident hypertension per standard definition. But I think the biggest area for improvement is that there are very few patients or a small proportion of patients who actually have appropriate management in the setting of hypertension. So we really need to work better with their cardiologists or their internists or do it ourselves to manage their hypertension. The other thing is she couldn't really determine a pattern of which agent worked best for managing this ibrutinib-induced hypertension. So this is an area that's wide open in terms of research, and she'll hopefully be publishing that paper in the near future.
Well, this is really fascinating. We'll follow it up. You know, we do a lot of surveys of both investigators and docs in practice. I can't wait to ask people what they do. I'll bet you most people give antihypertensive rather than reduce the dose like you did in this lady.
I think the answer is that most people do nothing because the patients don't have symptoms. There's a lot of, you know, people who say, go to your internist and address your meds, come back in 3 months, 3 months later, nothing. The other thing that's interesting is if you look at the longer term follow-up data that were presented by Susan O'Brien from the trials, the only adverse event that doesn't diminish with time is hypertension. All of the other ibrutinib-associated AEs go down. Like if you make it through year one, the chance of having an AE is diminished. But hypertension, there's a small proportion of patients per year that develop hypertension through at least the first 5 years. So it's one of these potential AEs where it's not, it's an issue on day one, but it's also an issue on year four that you need to consider.
That's really interesting because if you think about the typical situation where an oncologist will deal with hypertension of a side effect, it's going to be either an anti-angiogenic, it's going to be Bev or TKI. And again, the algorithm there is treat the hypertension and keep the drug going. And I think what you're saying is your algorithm is decrease the dose?
Well, in this case, the dose was decreased because of the arthralgia. My algorithm for the hypertension and the same for atrial fibrillation is manage them appropriately medically. So if a patient develops hypertension, I tend to not dose reduce.
Okay.
But I manage, if they're on one agent, I add a second. If they're on two, I add a third. If I can escalate the doses, I do. I work with their internist or their cardiologist. I actually think you can keep them on full dose in the setting of AFib or hypertension, as long as you're actually aware of the toxicity and managing it appropriately. The reason to dose reduce is for some reason you can't manage them medically, then you may want to think about that. But typically we try to keep them on their treatment dose. In this case, it was definitely dose reduced in the setting of arthralgia.
Well, though, that's interesting, though. When you dose reduced or because of the arthralgia, what happened to the hypertension?
Hypertension decreased, and I do think there may be a dose-toxicity relationship, but that hasn't been studied, and certainly that's not published.
Interesting. What do we know about sort of the dose relationship between BTK inhibitors and efficacy? You know, do you lose anything by decreasing the dose?
I think the short answer is I don't think so. So we actually conducted a study, retrospective study, which we published in 2015, I think, or 2016, in partnership with Georgetown and Hackensack, where we looked at all of the patients in our system who had dose reductions of ibrutinib within the first 3 months of exposure, who stayed on that lower dose, and compared it to all the patients who were on standard dose. And we couldn't detect a difference in PFS, OS, or response rate. So that data was published in BJH. Subsequently, there's been a paper in Leukemia and Lymphoma, and there's been some prospective data from MD Anderson published in Blood, which confirmed our hypothesis that if you have to reduce in the setting of AE, you probably don't lose much. I don't think that that's a rationale for starting at a lower dose, but if you have to do it, you can provide patients with a high level of reassurance. I think part of that may be mechanistically, but also part of that may be the fact that patients are not that large with CLL. And the data from the phase one suggests that if you do weight-based dosing, you need to at least get to 2.5 mgs per kg in order to have 95% occupancy of BTK. We measured our patients who got the low dose, and actually most of those patients, even at 280 milligrams a day, were still getting to 2.5 milligrams per kilogram. So they're probably still getting 90, 95% BTK occupancy, although we didn't test for that because it was retrospective. But the data from MD Anderson that are prospective in like 11 patients do support that with time, as you're having a reduction in the tumor mass, you may require less drug in order to control the remaining tumor bulk or the number of cells that remain. So it's an unanswered question, but I think low-dose ibrutinib, while not a standard of care, is reasonable in the setting of adverse event.
So you talked about some of the novel agent options, first-line therapy for the typical patient who's del-17p or p53 negative. What about those that are positive? Is this still ibrutinib or is venetoclax a consideration?
I think both are equal considerations. I think we have more data available in aggregate for ibrutinib and del-17p positive patients, but venetoclax has been also heavily studied in that patient population. There's a relapse refractory study, I think, reported by Stefan Stickelbauer in del-17p positive patients. And to me, they're equal efficacy in a del-17p patient. I don't differentiate one versus the other. I think some people do, but I don't think that there's a difference.
So it's been really interesting to hear about a lot of issues related to ibrutinib. Let's bring in acalabrutinib. And I asked you to maybe tell me about a patient that you took care of who received that agent, and you have a 67-year-old man. What happened there?
Yeah. So this 67-year-old, I guess the first thing I should say about acalabrutinib is that we do use it sometimes in CLL, but it's not yet FDA approved. So it's an off-label use of the drug. It's only really labeled now for relapse refractory mantle cell lymphoma. With that being said, this 67-year-old had enough medical comorbidities that weren't that well controlled that I had a concern about using ibrutinib. So they had poorly controlled atrial fibrillation and hypertension. So a decision was made, instead of starting with ibrutinib, to try to obtain insurance approval to use acalabrutinib. One of the limitations of the drug versus ibrutinib is it's a twice daily dosing versus once a day, but the patient was started on the drug and tolerated it reasonably well. A couple of things I wanted to highlight. One of the toxicities associated with acala that isn't frequently seen with ibrutinib is headache. And so this patient did have a grade 1 or grade 2 headache during the first 4 to 6 weeks worth of therapy, which is relatively easily treated with Tylenol, but the patients just need to be aware of that.
I've heard that described as, quote, attention headache. What do patients actually tell you?
Patients have actually described it as a headache unlike other headaches that they've had before. So I think probably the closest is attention headache. It's usually like back of the head, it seems like a little bit more, but there's no pattern that I've seen with that headache. The main feature is that it's not been severe, and in my experience, at least, never limited me using the drug or having to stop it because of headache.
I've heard from a number of people, including your former colleague, Craig Moskowitz, who came down here to Miami, where we are, talk about caffeine and these headaches. Have you seen that be helpful?
Yeah, so that is something that we have anecdotally recommended to patients. I actually think Tylenol works the best. Just a simple Tylenol seems to be a good solution for people. And the main thing is to tell them is that it's self-limited. And so I haven't really seen this be an ongoing problem beyond a few weeks worth of exposure to the drug. The second toxicity this patient had, which wasn't so severe, but was hypertension. And the reason why I wanted to highlight this is that we have now had longer-term follow-up data. I think the median follow-up was around 40 months presented at ASH by John Bird from Ohio State, where he looked at the Acala experience. And one thing that was interesting, while the AEs did not seem to be as much as we would have predicted with ibrutinib, although apples to oranges comparison, so you really can't draw it, one thing we did learn was that they did see some AFib, some hypertension, some bleeding with Acala. So some of those BTK-mediated toxicities still need to be considered. Now, we didn't get to mention this earlier, but there has been a head-to-head trial of ibrutinib versus Acala conducted in the relapse refractory setting, one-to-one randomization for patients with a deletion 17p or a deletion 11q. Those data will hopefully be presented in the next 1 to 2 years. That's really fortunate because it will give us a window into whether or not there are differences in the activity or the AEs associated with these drugs. But until that time, I try to think of them as similar in terms of what their potential toxicities are. Anyway, back to this patient, they did very well. The drug controlled their disease, and fortunately, there was not exacerbation of atrial fibrillation, for example. So no major issues long-term at this point in time.
So can you contrast sort of the pharmacology or the spectrum of kinase activity between acalabrutinib, ibrutinib, and I know there are other BTK inhibitors out there too?
Yeah, there's three main BTK inhibitors that are either approved or, in the case of the latter two, being extensively studied in CLL and lymphomas. Of course, ibrutinib is approved, frontline, relapse refractory. It has many lymphoma indications. It also has Waldenstrom's. It also has GVHD. So pretty broad use of the drug in B-cell malignancies and GVHD. The other two are acalabrutinib, which does have an approval for mantle cell, and zanabrutinib, or BGB-3111, which is being studied and does not yet have an approval, but we do have the prospect of seeing some randomized data in the near future. The kinome, or the kinase maps for ibrutinib and these drugs have been compared, and it does seem that there are many, many more targets associated with ibrutinib relative to the other two drugs. The other two appear to be a more clean, or pure, however you want to say it, BTK inhibitor relative to ibrutinib. I think to automatically assume that a more pure drug or a more clean drug is better than a quote-unquote dirtier drug, I think is not founded in reality. Probably some of the best aspects of ibrutinib's activity may be related to its off-target effects, particularly in GVHD, for example. I think that the mapping of what kinases are inhibited by these drugs is completely preclinical, and I think you and I would both agree what happens in a lab or in a test tube oftentimes is not mirrored in patients. And so we do have head-to-head data for Acala versus ibrutinib coming out, and there are also head-to-head data for zanabrutinib versus ibrutinib that will be coming out. I think from the perspective of clinicians, what happens in patients is most relevant, so we'll see what those data show us, if there are any differences or if the AE profiles are more similar than dissimilar.
In terms of kind of what it seems to be at this point indirectly, what about arthralgias in acalabrutinib?
They seem to be less commonly reported, but then again, it's hard to know. It's a, relatively smaller patient population. And, a lot of the AEs associated with these drugs really come out beyond the small subsets of patients treated in clinical trials. One example, our group at Penn reported on 4 cases of ibrutinib-related pneumonitis that we published in Blood, I think in 2015 or 2016. Those cases were all observations from our clinic. We went on to confer with other centers that this is something that is rarely seen as an adverse event. But if you look at just the clinical trial literature, that's not something that was highlighted or observed very clearly from the clinical trial experience. So I don't know. I think a real-world study in acalabrutinib is warranted, especially since there's a lot of off-label use of that drug, particularly in CLL. And I know my colleagues at Georgetown, Dr. Chesson and Dr. Yazdi, are conducting such a study right now. So hopefully at the next ASH meeting, we'll have some data to report.
What do you think the likelihood is that there's going to be a difference in efficacy between ibrutinib and acalabrutinib?
You know, it's really hard to speculate. Probably the most common people who want to answer that question are people who are investors trying to decide, you know, one drug versus the other. I really have no idea. I've had mostly favorable experiences with both drugs, and it may be that they're more close together than they are dissimilar from one another. You know, we're fortunate to have this wealth of riches of novel agents in CLL, where it's oftentimes when I talk about ibrutinib versus venetoclax or ibrutinib versus acalabrutinib that we're picking amongst all winners. These drugs are all active, have improved life for patients, have in many instances improved survival. So when you're dealing with, you know, if you were asking me to choose between like chlorambucil and ibrutinib, I could sit here and go on and on and on about why I feel one drug is better when there's such an obvious difference in activity. But until we see the randomized data, it's really hard for me to speculate and give an opinion that actually is based on fact. I think we have a wealth of riches and we're choosing between winners very often.
So when I hear about this 55-year-old lady with von Willebrand's disease who got venetoclax, eventually she had other therapies, I'm really curious, particularly in terms of how you managed her once she started the venetoclax. Can you talk a little bit about this patient?
Sure. She's a really very lovely patient who has been treated with several lines of therapy. So she, of course, started with chemoimmunotherapy prior to the approval of novel agents. And at least historically, she got FCR and then BR. And I actually met her while she was receiving idelalisib rituximab in the context of a clinical trial. I actually remember the exact moment when I heard about her case because I was at ASH learning about CLL and she was presenting to our emergency department as a new patient to us who I'd never met before. And at the time she was receiving idela, she was starting to progress, but more importantly, she had had these respiratory symptoms that ultimately turned out to be a PCP pneumonia. So that is a known potential risk associated with novel agents. They can develop opportunistic infections.
Could I just ask about that? Because when I saw that in the history, when I've been thinking about pneumonitis and PI3 kinase inhibitors or idelalisib, I thought it was immunologic and not infective.
Yeah, that's the thing is that both are possibilities. And so if you have a patient who's short of breath and hypoxic on idela, for example, I personally think they need to be admitted, they need to be bronched because you can't radiologically distinguish one from the other. And I've seen cases of both in the setting of PI3K inhibitors and also BTK inhibitors. There is an experience published in Blood from the NCI looking at PCP in patients who are receiving ibrutinib. So in this case, we admitted her, we bronched her, we had ID see her, and it turned out the bronch was positive for PCP, which in some ways is easier to deal with because we were able to start her appropriately on steroids and on Bactrim. She was able to get that under control. And then we wanted to get her treated with a novel agent. Unfortunately, venetoclax was not yet approved at the time, but we did have obinutuzumab. So she had symptomatic disease. Her spleen was the major issue, always has been. And so we gave her 6 cycles of obinutuzumab, got her disease without chlorambucil. She elected to not receive that, got her disease under relatively good control. Spleen was smaller, but not completely improved. And then fortunately, I can give you so many different examples that a drug gets approved nearly at the moment that a patient needs to have access to a new agent. This happens all the time in CLL. Fortunately,
that's because things are getting approved all the time in CLL.
Yeah, it's great. It's really, I mean, it's just CLL is one of the best areas to be in oncology because there's tremendous hope. And every month I feel like I'm telling patients about some new advance, which is really quite different than, you know, the pioneers in the field. You know, Dr. Rai would come to mind who had very limited tools available to him to help his patients. Right now, things are a lot different than they were 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, there were like 100 prognostic variables out there that nobody looks at anymore.
It's true. I think this is one of those examples where prognosis and biology preceded advancement in terms of therapeutics. I mean, Ehrlich was talking about the B-cell receptor in like 1902. You know, we didn't get an agent available to inhibit a B-cell receptor mediated protein for another 114 years. So sometimes we understand biology long before we understand how to deal with biology. But anyway, venetoclax became available for this patient. She received it as a monotherapy, relatively well tolerated. She's had some minor hematologic issues, but I can tell you she is still in remission on venetoclax as a monotherapy. Fortunately, we have now CAR T trials available and bispecific antibodies available. So I have a backup plan for what might come next if she progresses. But if this were, you know, if we could go back in time and set the stage for 2012 or 2013, I don't think this lady would have survived if we didn't have these novel agents available that we did over the last couple of years. Anyway, she's doing great, leading a very active life. She's had a couple of issues with hypogammaglobulinemia. She receives IVIG, but otherwise is actually doing very well.
How did you actually manage starting the venetoclax in her?
So when venetoclax was first approved, we were a little bit more conservative. So we did the ramp up in the setting of hospitalization for her. I think now she would probably be deemed medium risk, and I would probably do it completely in the office. But we admitted her once a week for 5 weeks. We gave her allopurinol, IV fluids, monitoring labs, you know, at our time point 0, 4, 8, 12, and 24, and just slowly escalated the dose between 20 milligrams and 400 milligrams. I think if the office is not equipped to do it, it's always reasonable to do it in the hospital. Although I think more and more, once you've done it a couple of times, it's relatively easy to do it in the office setting, as long as you have a stat lab available to you at an 8-hour time point.
I was going to ask you, when you talked about your real-world look at venetoclax, you know, the package insert with that table about what to do with TLS based on the white count and the nodes and all is sort of up in your face. I think most people look at that. But one thing I wonder about is how, and I think you kind of alluded to it, is how closely people look at renal function. Because like in the package insert, to me, it doesn't emphasize it enough that it's a critical issue. This lady's 55. I mentioned she had normal renal function. But how much of an issue is renal function in your decision about what to do about preventing TLS?
It's becoming more and more of an issue because, you know, if you look at the package insert, there's not a lot of guidance on how to stratify patients based on renal function. I think the creatinine clearance cutoff that they put in there is 80 mLs per hour is the cutoff that's in the label. So actually, our fellow, Dr. Roker, published a paper in CCR where she looked at patients based on their TLS risk per the label, low, medium, and high risk, and then added renal function stratified by, you know, less than 80 versus greater than or equal to 80 to see whether or not renal function impacted the risk of developing clinical or laboratory TLS. And the short answer was that it did. It was an independent predictor in her model. And that's only using 80 as a cutoff. That's all we had in our data set. We would love to look at other cut points. But it was an independent predictor. The odds ratio was somewhere between 2 and 3. And she actually went on to do ROC analysis, looking at the area under the receiver operator characteristic curve. I think it was like 65% for the FDA labeled low, medium, high. And if you added in renal function, it went up to 79 or 80%. So thinking about renal function, I think, is critical when you're deciding whether a patient could be outpatient or whether or not they should be hospitalized. And I'm hoping we're going to do some more research on that topic.
Yeah, I think there are a fair number of people with, you know, creatinine clearances in the 40 to 60 range, and I don't know what you do with them.
So we do our standard risk stratification, and then we decide very carefully, patient by patient basis, whether we hospitalize or not.
Whether you bump them up, sort of.
Yeah, or if they live 3 hours away, I put them in the hospital. If they live around the corner, I feel more comfortable maybe managing them outpatient. It really depends on the patient.
So I always like to see a case start out with 88-year-old patient because always curious about managing people as they get older. What happened with this patient?
You know, this is an interesting case because we're seeing more and more older patients with CLL who are eligible for everything. And, you know, it used to be that patients who were older really were relegated to receive rituximab monotherapy, which isn't labeled, or chlorambucil. But now we're seeing patients who come in who have some aspect of symptomatic CLL. And I feel very comfortable offering them multiple treatment options. In fact, most of the same ones I would offer a 55-year-old. So this patient was eligible to receive chemoimmunotherapy. They could receive ibrutinib. They could receive potentially venetoclax-based therapy today. And we also talked about the CLL11 data, which was chlorambucil plus obinutuzumab, which was compared to either rituximab, obinutuzumab, or chlorambucil. Positive trial for the primary endpoint. This patient elected for obinutuzumab by itself because of the fact that it was time limited. 88 years old, didn't want to be on a life, quote unquote, lifelong therapy, was hoping to get 6 months worth of therapy and then stop. And actually, this patient did very well, with the exception of minor infusion-related reactions, which I would argue during the informed consent process should be just discussed as a reality for almost all patients. They tolerated the drug well. They had some issues with cytopenias in the second cycle, but overall got through all 6 cycles and had a 2-year remission, which is very, very, I think, relevant for somebody, especially at that age point. And then ultimately, when they progressed a couple of years later, which might be the, you know, the expectation in terms of the median from the studies, they were able to then go on to receive ibrutinib-based therapy and do quite well. So I think this case is a great example of the fact that years ago, therapies were really largely stratified based on age and performance status. And as we understand how to target the disease better, more and more doors are open to patients with comorbidities or patients with advanced age.
I see that she had a little bit of an infusion, or grade 2 infusion reaction. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with infusion reactions with obinutuzumab, including in older patients? And, you know, I guess now with venetoclax obinutuzumab, it's going to be more of an issue.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't see more infusion-related reactions in older people, but I think that the risk to older patients is higher, mainly because they probably don't have the same organ reserve, either their ejection fraction or their pulmonary function, in order to deal with a significant IRR or to deal with the fluids needed where you may want to hydrate these patients, for example, in the setting of receiving an antibody. So you do the best that you can in terms of pre-medicating patients with antihistamines, Tylenol, corticosteroids. There's really ample evidence and guidance available in the label for obinutuzumab as to how to manage the prophylaxis for infusion-related reactions. You know, certainly as part of informed consent, you have to discuss that there's probably a 70 or 80% chance that you may see at least some minor issue. The most important aspect of it is being present to manage it, having a staff that are familiar with them, and knowing when to stop the drug. And, you know, the way the drug is supposed to be given, it's a split dose the first week. You get 100 milligrams day one, you get 900 milligrams day two. Plenty of times, if I have a patient who has an IRR day one, they get 50 milligrams into it, we oftentimes decide not to give day two and then just to resume week two. And if they started with a white count of 200,000 week two, 9 times out of 10, they come in with a white count of 30,000 or 20,000 and they do just fine. So like forcing it and requiring patients to be mandated to get through that 1,000 milligrams in the first week, I think that's the goal. But in reality, you think about the patient, and given none of these therapies are curative, the goal is to control the disease. And sometimes you may not be able to get the full dose in the first week or two. And patients can still do very well with that strategy.
You mentioned that she is on ibrutinib. How does she do on ibrutinib? Any tolerability issues?
In this particular case, no.
Nothing.
She's tolerating it okay.
Just out of curiosity, if she or somebody were to present with this exact situation today, 88 years old, what would be your likely therapy?
You mean as a first therapy or,
yeah,
or
first,
if they progress?
Yeah, this same lady would present for first-line therapy.
Well, I've taken chemoimmunotherapy off the table for a patient like this. So because of the Illuminate data and the data from the Alliance trial, like, I'm not really enthusiastic about giving BR or obinutuzumab to this patient. So I've shifted a little bit more towards recommending either venetoclax or ibrutinib to a patient like this. Although I still think that if they're looking to just have some quality of life improvement, address some symptomatic aspect of their disease, I still think obina is reasonable to consider. Just discussing that we do have now some randomized data from ibrutinib and venetoclax-based therapies that show that those are better.
It's interesting because this patient and also the previous patient actually earlier on got obina without the chlorambucil. How often do you do that? Kind of from the beginning, I started to hear people talking about and questioning really what chlorambucil was bringing to the table.
Yeah, I mean, it's an off-label decision, so I have to say that the label mandates to give chlorambucil, but my own practice is I really don't think it adds much but toxicity. And so my own practice is to discuss that with patients and offer them the chlorambucil, but if they're not interested in it based on the AEs, I'm perfectly comfortable with giving the obina as a monotherapy. I would say that's 95% of the time or more. And I've seen outcomes that, I, at least in my own judgment, are comparable to what is achieved with the addition of the chlorambucil.
There's not inconsequential amount of rituximab monotherapy used in community-based practice for CLL. How would you compare the efficacy of rituximab to obinutuzumab clinically? Not so much research data, but what you've actually seen.
I think obinutuzumab is more active. I really do. I think that rituximab as a monotherapy, its main role is largely for treating autoimmune hemolytic anemia, which can be associated with CLL, or ITP, which can be associated with CLL. Outside of that, to be honest with you, I think that the experience I've had with obina is that the remissions seem to be longer lasting. It may be a dosing issue, you know, because you're giving more milligrams of obinutuzumab over 6 months than rituximab. But, you know, we have what we have from the trials and what we do in practice. And so I very rarely will give rituximab as a monotherapy, again, outside of the window of an autoimmune mediated cytopenia.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Update.